Hello and welcome to Richard and Rishi in Conversation. Richard, I'm always keen to begin our conversations by checking on how you're doing. So how are you today?
Rishi, I'm very well. Thank you for asking. What about you?
In a similar vein, I also am very well indeed, and obviously enjoying all our podcast conversations, which so far we've been focusing on emotions and all the relevant strands of discussion related to how we deal with them, how we respond to them, the importance of being aware of them, accepting them, and expressing them. But today, I'd like to ask to begin by asking you why it is, do you believe that we struggle with our emotions in the very first place?
Oh gosh, Rishi, how much time do we have?
As much as you need.
Right then. I think you might have to jump in and stop me in case I get off on a rant about this. One of my favorite subjects. Why we struggle. Well, I think the place that I would start would be, and these are in what I'm going to share, I suppose, not in any particular order. There doesn't need to be an order to this, because I think each listener will be able to relate to perhaps each one of these suggestions. But let's take, for example, society and our culture and our communities and the way we're brought up. And what we are taught when we're younger about expressing how we feel, communicating how we feel, and what it means if we actually feel different things. And, you know, the amount of literature that I've read that refers to the importance of the environment into which we're born, in terms of dictating how we evolve emotionally and how our internal individual emotional ecosystems, if you like, develop. So imagine, if you will, that you're born into a family, into a household where emotional expression is free and easy and regular and normal. Well, you are then going to grow up having been imprinted with the understanding, with the belief that expressing yourself emotionally is okay, desirable, acceptable, the norm. The reality is that for most of us, it's more the opposite, where we're born into family units where how our emotions are dealt with is often something that perhaps is not exposed, but it's kept quiet. It isn't something that is easily and widely talked about as a topic. And I think that's because culturally, certainly here in the West, in the UK, culturally what we have learned to do is we've learned to judge people by the nature of their emotions and the way that they conduct themselves emotionally. So imagine, if you will, that you're faced with being judged unfavorably if, as a little boy, you cry. What do you think that's going to do to you as a little boy when you're on the verge of crying? You want to cry, but what you understand is that maybe crying might get you ridiculed or judged unfavorably. What's that going to do to you?
Got to keep that in. Got to keep that in, then.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense that you would, because by keeping in the urge to cry, you're going to avoid being judged unfavorably or rejected or laughed at or humiliated. And therefore, it's a bit of a no-brainer, isn't it? That last set of outcomes, if you do cry, far too painful, much easier, much more preferable to keep the tears in. And it can be something as simple as that. The fear of what will happen if we do, or if I do as a little boy, express myself. Now, let's throw in the mix here for little boys to start off with, the role models that we have in our lives. Typically, the male role model, the expectation of a male in the world is to be strong, is to be assertive, is to be safe, to be the savior, to be the fixer. And it's almost as if there's no space there to be gentle or vulnerable or to show one's emotions. So if when we're growing up, there's little or no space for us to do it ourselves, and the role models that we have in our lives don't do it either, and in fact, they do the opposite, and maybe they even suggest that there's something wrong with us if we don't behave in the same way as them, then very, very quickly and very, very easily, we are going to buy into the belief that there is very, very little that's positive or valuable in expressing how we feel, especially when it comes to men and especially when it comes to sadness, for example. Mm. And I'm aware that this is a sweeping generalization, but it does illustrate the point very well, I think. Because when we understand that our role models when we're younger and society's beliefs about how little girls should be seen and not heard and big boys don't cry, for example, when those beliefs are imprinted upon us at an impressionable age, well, it's perhaps no wonder we grow up fearing the consequences of expressing ourselves, not because we've thought about it and made a decision, but because of what we've been exposed to when we're younger. Because when we're younger, we're like sponges. Mm. We absorb everything that there is available to absorb in our environment, because what we want to do is we want to get as many frames of reference as we can possibly get in order to make sure we both survive and thrive in the world. And this first 7 years, for example, is the most significant, most important period of time in our lives. And it's referred to as the imprint period.
Okay.
And it is literally that. It's the period of time when we are imprinted with the beliefs, the attitudes, the values, the prejudices, the fears of all of those people around us who are key influencers in our lives. Mm. So this all takes place before the age of 7 anyway. And what chance do you think we have to be involved in how that emotional ecosystem evolves? We don't have the wisdom, we don't have the intelligence, we don't have the life experience, we don't have the knowledge. So really, without wishing to promote the idea of a victim mentality, a lot of it is done to us without us having any say in it, and without us really being able to do anything to combat it. So before we know it, we have been infused with the emotional behaviors of those around us, and consequently then, it makes perfect sense why we would then grow up with that emotional ecosystem inside us continuing to dictate how we behave emotionally. Now, I used sadness as an example there. Let's take anger. Now, anger, I would suggest, is probably the ugliest, most acidic, most ferocious, most unpalatable emotion that there is. because of the way that it's expressed when someone is feeling it. Would you agree with that? Is that fair?
Yeah.
Yeah. And no one likes to witness an angry exchange between other people. No one likes to be on the receiving end of an angry tirade from somebody. And I don't believe many people like to feel it internally themselves. So we've got plenty of plenty of frames of reference that anger's not good. There's nothing nice, there's nothing good, nothing healthy, nothing desirable about anger. So then we develop, quite understandably, I think, an aversion towards anger, whether it's in others, towards us, in ourselves, or really in any area of our lives. Anger becomes something that we tend to want to avoid at all costs. And let's throw into this mix the whole idea that if you're angry, oh my goodness, well, therefore you must be mad, bad, sad, and broken, and you need therapy. So there's a lot of stigma attached to the emotion of anger as well. So whether it's sadness on the one hand that we're afraid of expressing through tears or whatever it might be, or whether it's anger on the other that is clearly obvious when people are expressing it, there aren't a lot of safe havens when it comes to our feelings when we're younger. And then let's just throw into the mix, which I won't go into detail on yet, but let's consider the other major emotions, in particular, fear, guilt, hurt, shame, disgust. All of those also represent, if you like, a movement within us. So when we feel something internally, it's known as the emotion. When we label it, it becomes the feeling. So when we learn what labels go with what feelings, we're able to judge pretty quickly whether or not it's a good idea to admit that we're feeling that way. Now, I don't know how often you have come across, either in your upbringing, Rishi, or just people in your orbit and your environment, who willingly and easily give voice to how they're feeling. Mm-hmm. Things like, oh my goodness, you know, I feel really ashamed of having done or said that, or I'm really hurt by what you did or what you said, or I'm feeling guilty about not being there for so-and-so. I'm disgusted at the way that person chose to behave. I'm afraid actually of doing that in case it means this. This is not necessarily everyday language, although we will hear people using that type of language, but that's usually about as far as it goes. It's just language for most people on the outside.
Yeah.
But on the inside, we can't not feel these things depending on the circumstances. Mm. So back to the question of why do we struggle? Mm. We've got mixed messages. We haven't had good role models for how to conduct ourselves when it comes to our emotions. And when we understand how emotions can affect us, well, that really then makes them quite scary things to consider. Because if you've had a lifetime of, not a lifetime necessarily, that's being a little over dramatic, Richard, if you've had an extended period of time in your life where you felt angry but you haven't had an outlet, or felt sad but you haven't had an outlet, or felt ashamed but haven't had an outlet, then the consequences are that whilst you can still feel these feelings internally, if you haven't got an outlet for them, then you're going to stuff them in, you're going to sit on top of them, you're going to hold on to them, and do your absolute best to make sure that they don't come out. And that's the other fear why we struggle, because we're not sure what the consequences will be if we do express our feelings. Not only are we worried most of the time as to whether or not we'll be judged by others, but we're also uncertain about the impact on us in that moment, physically, emotionally. Will we have a breakdown? What will happen? Will I lose control? Will I fall over? Will I? Uncertainty around the consequences. Because we don't have many frames of reference for what happens when we express ourselves. And I want to throw one more thing in the mix if I can. A lot of the time, and adults do this very well, a lot of the time, when we hear somebody say how they're feeling, oh, I'm really nervous, or I'm really upset, or I'm really scared, what's one of the first things we say in response?
Oh, don't be. Don't be. You'll be fine.
Exactly right. And we didn't even rehearse that, Rich. Exactly right.
As soon as you said it, automatically it came into my mind, tell him it's going to be fine, not to be nervous.
Yes. And we don't do this by thinking, now, what's the best response in this moment for this person? What do I think they need to hear? We don't even do that. It's a knee-jerk response. Don't feel that way. Oh, hang on a second. So what you're saying is, what I'm feeling, I should stop feeling.
Yeah, thank you.
You're telling me to stop feeling that.
Yeah, thank you. Case closed.
I mean, come on. We're just not being fair to each other.
No.
Because it's a bit like saying, you are wrong to feel that way.
Yeah.
Which is another reminder that feelings aren't good, because people just bat them back to us. People will just say to us, don't feel that way. Oh, you shouldn't feel that way. Oh, don't be silly for feeling that way. So, you know, whichever direction we seem to turn, whether it's before the age of 7 or as an adult, we keep getting reminded it's not smart, not good, it's not clever, not intelligent, not grown up to express how you're feeling. So keep it to yourself.
Well, the two things that come to my mind here that I'd like to ask you about. The first thing is that obviously, there are a lot of parents, adults, key influencers, as you label them earlier on, walking around completely unaware of the effect that we're having on children, their development, and generation upon generation. And the other question, and I'm saying it now because I don't want to lose my train of thought, and so hopefully you'll remember it as well as I will, is that given how easily, when you said, I feel nervous, and how quickly and on autopilot I came up with, don't feel that way. It's such a imprinted reaction from me to behave that way. How difficult then is it to go about effecting change of that kind of behavior?
Well, how difficult is it to effect change in that type of behavior? Well, I actually wouldn't like to suggest how difficult it is. And that's because I think the degree of difficulty is going to vary from person to person. I get the sentiment of the question, though, because it sounds like, oh my goodness, this is going to be a big, big task.
Yeah.
And potentially it is, given that all of this stuff, this emotional ecosystem started being nurtured and created, the seeds were sown before the age of 7. And if we're now in our 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, oh my goodness, we've had a lifetime of living from that ecosystem. So, you know, in anyone's mind, they're going to think, goodness me, how can I possibly change something that's been going on for that long?
Mm.
So I get that as a sentiment. What I would suggest, though, is that the first thing we've got to do is we've just got to take a little bit of time out and realize that we're actually doing it. See, this is part of the problem. Most of us are living our lives unconsciously. I mean, we have to, because there are so many things that we could focus on in any given moment. Yeah. We can't possibly focus on every single thing.
I guess that's what I mean by autopilot. When you answer, when you ask a question, yeah, or you come up with a phrase like, you know, I'm nervous, and the autopilot kicks in to not really thinking behind your sentiment of what you're saying. When you say, or anyone says, I feel nervous, or I feel afraid, I feel scared, you go into the auto reaction, which is, don't be, you'll be fine.
Yeah, and that's a good example of how we've become programmed in specific areas, specific topics, specific subjects, to respond without thinking. But again, let's remember that the responses are learnt. Mm. We learn them at an early age. Anything we repeat, anything we practice, if we do it enough, it becomes unconscious, which then means it happens all on its own without us being involved. So this is why I say, what I believe is that the first thing we've got to do, if we want to change this behavior, first thing we've got to do is be aware that we're doing it in the first place. Because even though it might be a time to change, you know, change doesn't have to take time, but it does require that we are present, diligent, devoted to wanting to make the change. Because how many people do you know, Rish, or how often have you come across someone who said that they'd like their life to be different in some way, but it's only really been an idle wish because they've never really gone and done anything serious about it?
Quite a few, because they mentioned the sentiment of wanting to change, and then it stops there.
Yeah. And look, it's very, very easy to express a wish or a desire or a hope. Very easy. Because there's so many things that we could wish for, desire, or hope for. Very easy. So as well as, first of all, being aware of what we're doing and snapping out of it, although I'm going to quantify what I mean by snapping out of it. I'm going to say, not snap out, I'm going to reverse that. I'm going to say, wake up. We've got to wake up to the way that we are behaving in relation to our emotions and realize the damage that we are doing, not just to ourselves, but to those who we have governance over or influence over or responsibility for. Because the way that we behave goes out into our world and is experienced by everybody in our world. They do the same to us. And when it comes to children, because children live what they learn, then whatever we expose children to, they pick up on automatically. So, you know, there's a case for saying that our behaviors around our emotions didn't start with us. Because if we're influenced by our parents and how they conduct themselves emotionally, where do you think our parents were influenced? Or who do you think our parents were influenced by?
Their parents, and so on.
And so on, so on, so on. So, if you like, I believe that the baton for how we behave emotionally has been being handed down for generations. And what we are doing, unless we do something about it, is we're just carrying on those tendencies. Not literally and not 100% of the time, but in general terms, we're not changing the legacy. We're not influencing what future generations will do in relation to their emotions, because we are just carrying on unconsciously treating our emotions as if, you know, there is something wrong with them, or there's a reason to hide them. So I would say, look, let's wake up, first of all. Let's wake up to how we are behaving. Because if we don't, then these emotional artifacts, if you like, they'll get buried. They'll stay within the psyche. They will get passed on. Nothing really changes. So let's wake up. And then I would suggest that the next thing we've got to do is we've actually got to own up to how we're behaving emotionally. Call it what it is. Hand on heart and say, yeah, do you know what? I am responsible for suppressing or keeping down or avoiding or sidestepping or generalizing the way I feel about things. And do you know what? I haven't actually been entirely honest. And look, you don't have to do this to a group. You don't have to do this to anybody in particular. Mm. You've just got to do it for yourself first and foremost. Sometimes it helps sharing it with others. Sometimes it has to start with you, not you, obviously, but one being willing to own up and give voice to the fact that, yeah, do you know what? The way I've been conducting myself emotionally, hasn't been ideal. I can see now how it hasn't been ideal. And you know what? I'm committed to doing something about it. I'm committing to change it. Mm. Now, that is what I would call a very grown-up thing to do. Because it's a bit like saying, yeah, I'm not happy with my performance so far. I want to do something about it. It's important enough for me to do something about it. And that's, like I say, it's grown up, it's mature. Not only do I believe it's necessary, but really very, very valuable. So let's say we've woken up, we've owned up, we've grown up. Now what we've got to do is we've got to show up. We've actually got to start behaving differently in relation to our emotions. Easier said than done. But if we can start behaving differently when it comes to expressing our emotions, we are going to find that the responses that we feel internally and the reactions that we get externally are going to have to change. But those responses, internal and external, are going to actually be based on us speaking our truth about how we're feeling. Mm. Because this is what I think a lot of people fundamentally miss when they're presented with the prospect of start expressing how you're feeling. It's nothing more than an expression of the truth of something. Whether it is anger or sadness or fear or guilt or hurt or shame or disgust, it would be being completely and totally honest and transparent about how you're feeling. Now, we know, because we talked a little earlier, as to why that in itself is very difficult, because we're afraid of being judged, we're afraid of being rejected, we're afraid of someone saying, oh, don't feel that. Very dismissive towards our feelings. So we've got plenty of frames of reference that say, not a good idea, not safe, you'd be an idiot if you do. But what we've got to do is we've got to say, okay, if indeed it makes me an idiot, then I'm prepared to be an idiot for the period of time it takes me to transform from being someone who sits on their emotions to someone who has a better, more honest, more authentic relationship with their emotions. So it means then we've got to show up. The talk is over. The theory is over. We've actually got to start behaving in a way that demonstrates we are no longer going to be captive by, is that right English? I'm not sure. Captive of, something like that. Captive of, thank you, of our emotions. And that's the showing up bit. So if you like, with wake up, own up, grow up, and show up, we've got to get up ourselves when it comes to our emotions, I think. That's how I'd sum it up. Get up yourself with your emotions. Learn that it really is important. And when we make it important enough, that's when we'll do something about it. We've just got to make it important enough.
The number of people this affects is obviously every single human being in the world. And given the importance of expressing your emotions that you have highlighted, waking up to them, owning up to them, and showing up, it suggests that, you know, emotions obviously are so important for our well-being. The big topic in the world at the moment, or general, for the last few years, is becoming increasingly more prevalent to talk about mental health and the relationship that people talk about mental health to do with emotions and the suppression of emotions, etc. I mean, from what I've read over time, Richard, I've read that there are over 200 classified forms of mental illness. But would they all trace back, for example, to emotions? Is that the main cause or the main reason for what people describe as mental illness?
That's a great question, because the answer is very much dependent upon which research you are willing to follow and buy into. Because as is often the case in this type of, in this field and this type of subject, there's contradictory, conflicting research that would suggest yes is the answer to your question, no, or maybe is the answer to your question. So the way I would like to address it, if I may, is to first of all get clear about this term mental health, because I'm not really happy with the way that it's used. Listen to me, I'm not very happy with the way it's used, but it's misleading, because mental health in itself doesn't tell us anything about the situation. I mean, if I say to you, let's talk about your physical health, you would say to me, okay, so what aspects of my physical health do you want to talk to me about?
Yeah.
And if I said to you, let's talk about your mental health, well, perhaps the same question should follow. But no, it's not what we've been sold, if you like. We've been sold that just the term itself, mental health, means there are problems, there are issues, there are disorders. So I know it's not a big thing for me to have an issue with, but nevertheless, I think it's very important that we call things whatever they are. And mental health doesn't tell us really what we're talking about, other than the entire breadth of your mental health.
Yeah.
Now, what does the term mental suggest to you in the context of health? What area of health are we talking about if we're talking about mental health as far as you're concerned, Rish?
My mind.
Your mind, yeah. And I think most people would agree.
Yeah.
Mental, mind, head, thinking, thoughts. Yep, okay, fine. So then there's no reference in that, or there's no real pointers to include or suggest that maybe emotional health is in there as well. Fair comment?
Yes.
Mental suggests it's all in the mind, or it's all of the mind.
Yeah.
Which necessarily means that we discriminate against emotions because they're not included in the description. So for me, and this is where I'm going with my displeasure at the use of mental health, I believe it should be mental and emotional health,
okay,
not mental health by itself. So if you'll allow me to refer to it as mental and emotional health,
Yeah. Then
it will allow me to illustrate the answer that I'd like to give. Because when we talk about mental health, a lot of people will talk then about the quality of their thoughts, what they're thinking.
Yeah.
And of course, we all have thoughts. We can't survive without having thoughts. And typically, we've grown up in a world that tells us thoughts are either positive or negative. But what we've missed is that the thought itself is only either troublesome or supportive, depending on whether or not there's an emotional charge attached to the thought. You get that? An emotional charge. So you could think about something from the past, and then depending on that thing that you talked about, what would probably follow almost immediately would be a feeling that would accompany that thought. Yeah?
Yeah.
Now, what type of feeling would make that thought a negative thought, for example?
Anger, sadness.
Yeah, and what type of feeling would make that a positive thought, for example?
Pleasure, happiness.
Yeah. So depending on the emotion that follows in the wake of the thought, for me, that then determines whether or not the thought is negative or positive, but more importantly, gives us a clue as to the impact of the thought. Because the impact is the emotion that follows it. Let me introduce the idea of a neutral thought. What do you think a neutral thought might be?
Well, one that doesn't elicit a feeling. Or a significant feeling?
Well, just is flat or devoid of an emotional charge of any description.
Okay.
Because the thought itself has no impact one way or the other emotionally.
Yeah.
It's just a thought about something. It doesn't move you positively. It doesn't move you negatively. So really, is that thought, can that thought ever be problematic? Really?
No.
Well, you would think not, because there's no consequence to that thought.
Yeah.
But let's now move over to the negative side of this spectrum. And if we're agreed that negative thoughts are determined by the emotion that accompanies the thought, then what do you think would happen if the emotion didn't exist? You could still have the thought, but the emotion was no longer there. What would that mean about that thought itself?
It was flat as well.
It would become neutral, yeah?
No impact.
It would have no impact because there's no emotional charge. Likewise, with a positive thought, if there was no feeling that went with it, well, it would just become a thought, neutral, flat, nothing in it, give or take. But then having that thought would be of no consequence, right?
Yeah.
Just no consequence. So this realm of mental and emotional health, for me, has to be based upon the understanding that for a large majority of the time, not all of the time, no, a large majority of the time, it is the thought and its accompanying emotional charge that determines the effect that that thought has on us. So then what we need to become aware of is the emotional impact of the thought and work on the emotional component of the thought, because if it really is the emotional component that does the damage, as it were, then if we resolve the emotional component and there is no emotional charge to whatever the thought might be, that thought then becomes no threat whatsoever. And one of, here we go, another problem that I have with the industry that I'm part of is that a lot of the time, the advice that is given is change your thinking.
Yes.
Move your thinking from that thing to another thing. And, you know, a lot of the time, if you move your thinking from something that's negative onto something that's positive, and you are able to then feel that positive emotional charge that comes with that positive thought, then you may well feel as though what you've successfully done is moved on from that previous negative thought.
Yeah.
Well, you've certainly distracted yourself, so that's a good job done. But what do you think has happened to the negative emotional charge that was tethered to that thought that you just moved on to?
Still existing. From?
The charge still exists. And where do you think it exists?
Somewhere in our body.
Correct. So even though we might change what we are thinking about, and therefore potentially change what we're feeling, the feeling that we were moving away from by changing the thought in the first place, the feeling still exists. Mm. The feeling is still buried alive. The feeling still has the capacity to show itself at some later point in time. So one of the things that I believe that we really need to be educated on when it comes to this subject of mental health is, first and foremost, it's not exclusively mental, and it should be, in my opinion, extended to be mental and emotional. And it's about understanding that as long as there is a negative emotional charge attached to a thought, that changing that thought does not resolve the emotional charge. Mm. And therefore, work needs to be done with the emotions, not the thoughts. Because have you ever tried to do this yourself? Been thinking about things you'd rather not think about because of the way they make you feel.
Yeah.
And you've tried to think about something else.
Yeah.
I mean, how easy have you found it?
Not very easy at all.
Okay. And there's a reason for that. Yeah. Now, it's like anything. If you practice it enough, you could master the art of avoiding your negative thoughts and hopefully therefore the negative feelings that go with them. And you could, he is hoping, live a life of blissful ignorance, only ever thinking about and focusing on the things that make you feel good.
Yeah.
Hurrah. Yeah. Yeah. And some people have gone down that route. But what that actually means is that they're avoiding. Mm. They're ignoring. They're almost denying the existence of these feelings in the hope that in doing so, they either won't reappear, will either disappear, or just never bother us again. And because emotions are based upon energy, this is the origin of the word emotion, is energy in motion. Mm. Every time we feel an emotion, what we are actually feeling is the movement of energy through us. It's actually physiologically happening to us when we're feeling something. And if we refuse to allow that emotion to be fully expressed, what we are effectively doing is we are putting a cap on, we are putting a lid on, we are stopping the flow of energy.
Yeah.
And when we stop the flow of energy anywhere in our body, it's only a matter of time before there becomes a buildup, a blockage, and then the system where the blockage and the buildup has happened, whether it's the nervous system, the endocrine system, the skeletal system, the system starts to have to compensate for the blockage, which can then create other problems in other parts of the body. But because we tend not to consider blocked emotions as a major cause of these problems, we then look elsewhere and we look at symptoms and try to fix symptoms, or we look at the brain and we look at the way people are thinking, try and change their thinking. And whilst there's some element of validity in that, I'm of the opinion that the greater percentage of the experiences that we have in life, whether it's mental illness, whether it's physical illness, a large component of the root cause of those types of illnesses is linked directly to our emotions, how we deal with them, whether or not we express them, whether or not we create blockages. And consequently, if we don't look at this area of who we are as a human being, our emotional landscape, our emotional ecosystem, then we're not going to give ourselves the best chance of resolving and healing whatever it is we've become aware of that needs attention. So there's a place, absolutely, for the brain responding in a certain way, the chemicals within the brain creating certain scenarios within the body. The body and the brain are connected, the body and the mind, the body and the heart, the body and the gut. It's all interconnected. So therefore, it's very, very difficult, and I believe it's unwise, to treat them separately, which is why I'm an advocate of, let's call it, mental and emotional health, rather than just mental, because it suggests then that we're only dealing with the head, the brain, everything from the neck up.
Yes.
That's just not the case.
This therefore must mean that we're all existing, all of us, with a degree of, trying to find the right phrase, emotional unhealthiness.
Yeah, let's go with that for now. I mean, I can think of a couple of others.
Go for it.
Emotional constipation.
Yeah.
We're all on the verge of emotional combustion.
Yeah. So every single person has a degree of this in their life.
Yeah, I think that would be a safe bet. If you were a betting man, Rish, then I'd advise you to put money on that, yes.
I mean, therefore, you know, when we talk about things like mental well-being or mental health, as we've touched on, you, I know you talked about how you would like it, or your displeasure at some of the phrases used.
What a polite way of saying it, my displeasure. I love that. Can I use that?
I wrote displeasure down on my notepad once you said it, because I love the way you said it. But obviously, the discussions that we hear on a daily basis, or, you know, on the news or in current affairs about mental health in particular, people talk about people with mental health issues as if they have something that can be cured primarily by science. What you've explained is that a lot of it, or the majority of what seems to be at play, is the emotions. And repairing, is that the right word? Or making the emotional expression better, might be a better phrase or way of saying it, is a more valuable tool in combating what is commonly perceived now as mental health issues.
Yeah, look, I don't think we need to necessarily say it's a more valuable tool, because depending on who is handling the tool itself, being metaphorical for a moment, that then determines its usefulness. So what I would contest, what I'm advocating for, is first of all an understanding that addressing the emotional component of any ailment, illness, is going to be absolutely valuable in terms of healing whatever it is that seems to be in need of healing.
Right.
Nice and broad.
Yeah.
To what degree dealing with the emotional component is going to affect the outcome, that's a bit of an unknown, other than the research that I've read and the research that I've done, which would confirm that anywhere between 60 and 95% of what ails us mentally and physically can be put down to the way that we conduct ourselves emotionally. 60 to 95%, depending again on which research you're happy to accept. It's very rare for me to use the word research. I normally use the word me-search. And that's because what I've learned is that the majority of research is done by people who want that research to serve and suit their point of argument. So, yes, research, me-search, whichever way we look at it, there's plenty to support, without a shadow of a doubt, that by ignoring the emotional aspect of who we are reducing the likelihood of getting an outcome that we want. It doesn't mean we won't get an outcome that we want. It just reduces the likelihood because there's such a large percentage of the problem in the first place is caused by this this behavior of emotional constipation, emotional suppression. So for that reason alone, it's got to be worth, hasn't it? Exploring that. I mean, do everything else. Absolutely. Look at your diet. Look at your lifestyle. Look at your environment. Consider how much of it is genetic. Oh, and by the way, I've got an opinion on that as well that's based absolutely on research. But that's for another conversation, maybe. Even if you address all of those areas, the what we might call traditional or time-honored approaches to changing your health, your physical health, and in some cases, mental health. If you do all of that and you end up getting the result that you want, that you're happy with, and it remains that way, then of course, Yen, you're going to give credit to either the diet change or the lifestyle change or the environment change. That makes sense. There seems to be a causative link. I changed my diet, my headaches went away. I changed my lifestyle, my irritable bowel syndrome cleared up, or whatever it might be. But that doesn't change the fact that behind the scenes, there's this ongoing drip, drip, drip effect of unresolved, unexpressed, typically negative emotions that haven't been resolved, haven't been effectively dealt with and expressed, that is continuing to wear us down. Because the chemicals that are released by the brain every time we experience an emotion go into the body, place a demand on the body. And if we keep doing it relentlessly, and a lot of the time, like we said earlier, because we get used to doing it, it becomes unconscious, so we're not aware that we're doing it, then we're constantly loading the body with more that we require it to deal with. Most people are familiar with the hormones cortisol and adrenaline, for example. And for someone who is continuously in a state of high alert or fear or anxiety, if you like, that means that the brain is reliably, consistently, and faithfully producing cortisol and adrenaline for the purposes of dealing with whatever the threat might be that the person is anxious about. And again, it tends to be the truth that anxiety and doubt and uncertainty and fear tend to be learnt patterns of behavior over time. They become unconscious, but nevertheless, the body continues to operate. So imagine, if you will, that cortisol and adrenaline are continuously being fed into the body. Let's compare it to the sea just lapping up against a rock consistently without seemingly much extra effort, but regularly as the tide comes in, the tide goes out, the water washes up against the rock. What happens to that rock?
The rock stays where it is, but it gets worn away a little bit. It erodes over time.
That's it. And that's what happens internally. If we keep bombarding our internal systems with these hormones that actually are not used in the way that they're meant to be used. And one of the ways to use them is to actually be moved by them. And one of the best ways that we can move the internal and influence, rather the internal chemistry of our body, is to give voice to the truth of how we are feeling. It's not the only thing, but perhaps you can see that given the choice between keeping a lid on everything or finding an outlet, I mean, which would you go for?
Find the outlet.
Yeah, in principle you would. When I position it like that, maybe it's a bit of a no-brainer.
Yeah.
And yet we still don't do that. Part of it, I believe, is education, not knowing. Part of it, I believe, is misinformation. I think a lot of the time what we are told and what is promoted is off target. But even then, let's say you do understand, you are aware, you appreciate that, hey, it's going to be good for me to start expressing my emotions. What might stop you doing that, even though you realize and know and have reached the conclusion it would be a good idea?
Possibly fear of change.
Well, if we drop the possibly and of change.
Fear.
Yeah. Absolutely right. If we were, and this subject doesn't deserve putting in a nutshell, but if we were to put it in a nutshell, ultimately, the thing that causes us the greatest amount of distress, consternation, trouble is fear. Fear is a code word for stress and vice versa. And if you think about, not right now, because I'm not sure we have the time to do this, but if you were to think about, Rish, everything that causes you stress in your life, and I know you have a pretty cushy life, however, see if you can get into that headspace. If you were to boil down everything that you were aware of that stressed you, you'd get down to the bottom, the ground floor, which would be fear. And then you would realize that the ultimate fear for virtually all of us, without much exception, the fear of loss. The fear that we will lose something if, which goes back to what we were talking about earlier on. What are we afraid will happen if we do express ourselves as a little boy or a little girl? We will lose love. We will lose connection. We will lose acceptance. We will lose the things that we value the most. What's it like to lose anything?
Painful.
It's horrible. It really is one of the worst experiences. Depending on the nature of the loss, of course. But we cannot go through life without experiencing loss. Some losses are obvious. Loss of a pet, loss of a parent, loss of a job. But some of them, much more subjective. Loss of reputation, loss of love, loss of identity, loss of sense of worth. Still losses, yeah?
Yes.
So if we can understand that loss is the thing that creates stress when it happens, and the fear of loss creates even more stress before it's happened, because we're afraid of losing something, then what we tend to do is we tend to set up our lives, articulate our relationships, and position everything in such a way that if there's one thing above all others we do not experience, it is loss. Because what will happen if you do lose something very, very important to you? Well, we're likely to feel very sad, right?
Yeah.
It makes perfect sense. But what do we know about sadness? Ooh, careful. You don't want to go there, because you might lose your reputation. You might lose friends. You might lose a sense of connection. Do you want that? No, thanks. No. Well, in that case, don't express it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, but I'm feeling it so. Yeah, but I tell you what, if you do that, look at the consequences. Oh, okay. Right. Well, I'll just keep it to myself. Oh, no. And then we do that every time we feel something we're afraid of expressing. So what do you think the net effect is of doing that every time? Again, unconsciously. Yeah. We're not thinking about this. We're doing it unconsciously. Well, what do you think the net effect is?
Well, we're becoming very good at it, at avoiding or creating a life to prevent ourselves having to face it. But also it's quite tiring. It's quite a task each day trying to manage your life to avoid something.
Yeah, let's drop the quiet. It's tiring. It's hard work. It's stressful. It's demanding. It is a burden. Thankfully, we've got this thing called our unconscious that can take care of it for us.
Mm.
Oh, thank goodness for that. But not really, because you see, what the unconscious will do is it will preserve these feelings. We have to engage consciously. We have to engage in the expression of. Now, expression or express means to move on out.
Mm.
We have to engage in the movement out of the feelings and the emotions that we first experienced internally, so that those feelings and emotions do not eat up, do not form part of the fabric of who we are internally.
Mm.
Unfortunately, for most of us, that's already the case by the age of 7 anyway. So then what we're doing is we're constantly adding to this emotional patchwork quilt that we are knitting together in the background of our lives, and it just becomes bigger and bigger. The patches become smaller and smaller, but nevertheless, there's a pattern emerging. The unconscious takes care of it. And then before we know it, our lives are being interrupted by feeling things we'd rather not feel. Or our lives are being interrupted by physical symptoms. Or our lives are being interrupted by mental disorders, for want of a term. Or our lives are being interrupted by stressful life scenarios. Guess what's at the heart of every single one of those interruptions?
Yep.
Our emotions. Our unexpressed emotions.
Mm.
Our unreconciled emotions. I suppose one way of looking at it is that as we're growing up, we become emotionally domesticated. We conform. We fall in line. We want to be part of the tribe. We want to belong, and therefore we act like the tribe in order to stay part of the tribe. We don't develop our own emotional dexterity. We develop the capacity to create emotional distress on an ongoing basis. Our bandwidth, our emotional bandwidth, becomes narrower and narrower the more we refuse to express the truth about how we're feeling. Our emotional fabric becomes tainted and colored. The emotional tapestry becomes all higgledy-piggledy, unrecognizable to the human eye, but nevertheless a very real backdrop. And before we know it, if this goes on for too long, there'll come a point when we emotionally combust. Mm. So I suppose what I'm saying is the smart thing to do is to get into some sort of emotional archaeology. That can be scary for people, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So there's another reason why we don't do it. Fear of what might happen. Yeah, what might happen? Let me ask you this question, Rish. What do you think might happen? Or what do you fear might happen if we were to go exploring the emotional artifacts that are buried in your back garden under the patio, for example?
It's going to bring back to the surface the emotions that have been nicely tucked away in places never to be seen again and felt again.
Yeah. So first of all, we dig up your patio, so you'll need a new patio unless we dig it up carefully. Yeah. Now, we don't know how far down we're going to have to dig, but we're going to have to put the soil somewhere, right? So we've got plenty of reasons why we wouldn't want to go digging these things up. So it's understandable that we wouldn't. But really, the choice is either to try and keep them buried out of sight and hope that they never gather the strength or the power to affect us again. Or we hold our hands up and say, do you know what? I would rather be proactive here and be the one to go lifting up the patio slabs one at a time, moving just a couple of spadefuls of soil at a time, picking out one or two things to deal with at a time, and doing it in a way that makes me feel good about what I'm doing, but without running the risk of being overwhelmed or overloaded by the prospect of digging the whole patio up at once.
Yeah.
That's certainly an option for sure. But one of the things that most people are going to have to be willing to face, if you like, is the very real fear that goes with, yeah, but what will happen if I do? And there are many skilled professionals out there who can help with that. It's not the only option. Mm-hmm. I would suggest it's a preferable one, because if you work with someone who is skilled and effective, then it's likely to be quicker than doing it on your own. But look, some people have done it on their own very successfully. Ultimately, it's got to be down, I think, to each individual to not only wake up, own up, grow up, and show up, but to actually be up for what it's going to take them, or what it's going to take for them to actually do something that in their heart of hearts they probably realize would be worthwhile, would be of benefit, but maybe at this point in time they're just not sure how worthwhile and exactly what the benefit would be. But the choice is either continue as you are or do something with what you now know about the role and the influence unexpressed emotions have, and find a way of making it work so that you can be more responsible, where you can be more proactive in doing something with those parts of you that you've shut down. Because to continue to shut down our emotions is not much different from what happened to most of us as children. Most of us as children, we were shut down. And we were shut down at different times, whether it's for our exuberance, for our joy, for our noise, for our keenness. We didn't want to go to sleep at night, or we wanted to stay on the swings a bit longer, or we wanted to play in the park, playing football or cricket or whatever it was, just for a little bit longer. When we're told we can't or we mustn't, when a threat is held over us if we don't do something, or indeed if we do do something, parts of who we are get shut down. We've got to stop doing the shutting down thing not a very technical term, but we'll go with it for now. If we shut down our emotions, it's back to being childlike again.
Yeah.
We've got to interrupt that pattern as well. So I've talked about, you know, waking up and owning up and growing up and showing up and getting up ourselves. The way to get up is to stop shutting down.
Well, you mentioned wake up, own up, show up. You've spoken about a very powerful message about the fear of loss and stop shutting down. If I were to ask you, well, I'm going to ask you, for the takeaway from today's conversation of all the things you've spoken about, and in fairness, any single sentence we can take away from today as being important. But what would you want to highlight above all else as today's takeaway?
I think I would, Rish, I would go with, I go back to something that was mentioned at the beginning, indirectly, and that is that, you know, to struggle with our emotions, it's natural. It really is natural. This is not about blame. This is about understanding. This is not about fighting. This is about allowing into our awareness the reality of what's happened. We don't need to focus on whether or not we were shut down. We don't need to focus on exactly why we struggle. We do, I believe, first and foremost, need to be kinder to ourselves and understand that the emotional patterns that we've developed over time are unlikely to have started with us, which means they're not really ours, which means that what we've been doing all our lives is continuing to carry the baton of previous generations. And again, this is not about blame. This is just about understanding. There's nothing wrong with you. You're not at fault for anything. The reality is that all of us, virtually everybody alive today, finds themselves at one time or another in their lives struggling to deal with their emotions, and for very understandable reasons. If we want to reduce the amount of time that we spend struggling with our emotions, we have to develop a more congenial relationship with them, less adversarial. Let's not see them as the enemy. Let's see them as a very important part of us that provides us with information that is very, very useful. And if there's any area of our lives in which we want to feel better, we've just got to get better at feeling.
Richard, thank you. So, in summary, all of us find ourselves at one time or another struggling with our emotions. We need to reduce the time spent struggling, and we need to develop a more congenial relationship with our emotions. Thank you very much for today. It has been wonderful chatting, thoroughly fascinating, completely enthralling from start to finish.
Well, it's been my pleasure, Rish. Thank you for having me again.
And I cannot wait till the next time, Richard. Thank you.
You're welcome.